Good. All right, thank you all for being here. I call to order the meeting of the UTEMCO Board of Directors. The date is March 2nd, 2016. The time is now 3:10 p.m. The first item on the agenda for discussion and appropriate action relates to the minutes of the January 15th, 2016 board meeting. Are there any comments or changes to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. The next item relates to endowment and operating funds update report. Bruce, would you please present the report?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Remind everyone, we are audio webcast. We have a UT journalism student, Marcia Berkman, with us. And you're very welcome. And then welcome our friends from UT System. And to those of you on the UT Board of Regents, I apologize because what we have here is quite similar to the material that I raced through at the Regents meeting a few weeks ago. But because I raced through it so quickly and because we have a broader audience, I thought that it would still be useful to go over. And we haven't closed the books on February yet, so we're only about 4 months into the fiscal year in any event. What this material does is it goes through calendar years, clearly calendar year 15, but also goes back 3 years, 5 years to give some perspective. And the idea is to go a little deeper into the portfolio so that you get as full a sense as possible, all the detail you want on how the money's invested. And my colleagues will share their perspectives and respond to any questions you have as we go through the various parts of the portfolio. I think it'll also be helpful because we may want to spend some time in this meeting beginning the discussion on investment strategy. I emphasize beginning. It's a discussion we continuously have, but we're required to do it every year, and so we're kind of a little early this year getting started, but I think it'd be helpful to get started. And I think going over the current portfolio in some detail, beginning to think about investment strategy is just the right pre-work for the conference tomorrow, where we'll hear from so many of our most talented partners across the global capital markets. So hope you enjoy the show. Behind tab 2, page 2, paper, page 9 on Diligent, we are right under $35 billion between the PUF and the JEF, about three-quarters of the money, $25.6 billion, the intermediate term fund, $7.1 billion in cash. On the next page, this is our exposure page. The rows on the side are the asset groups, stocks, bonds, and real assets, and then within each of those, a division with fixed income between investment grade and credit related, in stocks, developed countries, and emerging markets, and in real assets, real estate, natural resources. The columns are investment styles, long only, hedge, private investments. And so down the bottom right, you see this represents that $25.6 billion of assets. We put the JEF and the PUF together because they are invested almost completely identically. There is one, the private investments can get slightly out of kilter depending upon the cash flows, because the JEF's cash flows and the PUF's cash flows, particularly money in, doesn't come in similarly. So over time, we're able to get that balance, but at any given time, it might be slightly off. And then we have a public equity mandate in China. We have a partner over there, and that, for technical reasons, that mandate isn't exactly the same between the PUF and the JEF. But other than that, you know, 99% identical. We, as of December, on the bottom right, we were up to $8.5 billion in private investments, a third of the portfolio. You'll see as of January later on, we're up to 35%. We'll kind of go through how we've grown, why we've grown to the extent that we have grown. We were at about 28% 6 months ago. The hedge fund book is at 29.4%, and the long-only book, 37.4%. Going up the top left, that long-only investment-grade fixed income, $1,570,000,000, is, we affectionately call it the mattress or the piggy bank. That's very liquid, very safe. The second line, credit-related, we've got $1,001,000,000 in the hedge funds and then $950,000,000 in private investments, so a total of just over $2 billion in credit-related strategies. Together, those represent about 16% of the assets. In the real asset line on the public real estate, those are REITs, 2.4%, and then we've built the private real estate book up to just under $1,489,000,000, up to 5.8%. So in total, we have about 8.2% of our assets in real estate strategies. Natural resources, $1,003,000,000 in the long only. That includes public equities, gold, and commodities. That number has come down since December because we have brought down our commodity
exposure. Came down in December.
Yes. We're up to $2 billion in natural resources-related private investments. As you'll see later, about half of that is energy-related. The other half is spread between agriculture, mining, and infrastructure. The largest part of our book are still public equities. A total of two-thirds of our book, almost two-thirds, 62.7%. Just under $6 billion are long-only public equities. We've got about $6 billion that are in hedge fund strategies, and $4 billion in the private investment book. And we'll go through those in more detail.
Bruce, can I ask? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to ask about the number of partners.
Yes.
That you have listed. That's a new line, and that's great. Some of those must be the same. You've just summed the 241 on the right is just the sum of the three columns?
Should be, yes,
but
sir.
Do you have some managers that offer both a long-only and a...
We do. So there's some. So there is some double counting. Number one. Number two. You know, particularly in the private investment column, those are not all active private investment managers. I think we have a private investment going back to 1986 that hasn't fully monetized. So on the more active private investment managers, it's probably about 100. 75 to 100. Now, on the hedge fund book, the 45, I'm looking for Ryan.
There's seven that are currently.
So about 38 okay. At, yeah.
Good, thanks.
And then in the 47, I know there's one that we have $1 million with that is still. So there's a few. We put the full number in, but they're not all active.
One question, and it's not relevant to anything now, but 4 or 5 years ago, what percent of the total was in private equity?
About 8 years ago, when I first got here, it was about 12%. And then, so about 5 years ago, it was probably up to about 25%. So we've been building that book up. We had very little in credit, private investments, a few hundred million. You can see that's now $1 billion. It had gotten larger. It's coming down. We had no real estate, no private real estate. The resources was probably also, again, a few hundred million. We had really very little in emerging markets. Most of the private investments we had back then would have been in that developed country line, and it would have been the big buyouts and some venture. So, and we don't have any of the big buyouts. So the book's not only grown dramatically, but it's a completely different composition.
Thank you.
The next page shows the returns for the periods ending December 31st, just over 40 basis points for the year in the PUF and the JEF. So hardly outstanding returns, although they were positive returns, and we'll show you how that compares to most markets. For the trailing periods, depending upon the fund and the period, anywhere from 5.6 to 6.3%, so around 6%. We were negative in the intermediate term fund for the year. About 30% of that's investment-grade fixed income, and as we'll take you through later, that was a negative year. And then about 40% in hedge funds, which was slightly positive for the year, but overall negative, positive over the trailing years. And again, we'll show you how that compares to how the money had been invested and versus the goal. The next page is the active management value add. We had a positive year. These are the endowments, 74 basis points. So that 40 basis point overall return in the endowments would have been negative about 30 basis points if it wasn't for the 74 basis point value add. Over the 3 and 5 years, just over 130 basis points, 10 years, 172. And then you can see the dollars, $200 million for 1 year, $1.1 billion 3 years, et cetera. We look at, and what we also are showing on this page is the volatility risk adjusted returns over volatility. Volatility is one of the 10 risks we highlight, and these are kind of the most normally used measures of this particular risk element with returns, a Sharpe ratio and information ratio. We have a relatively lower volatility portfolio, so our denominator tends to be a little lower, but if you don't have much of a numerator, you're not going to have much of a ratio. So the Sharpe ratio of 0.07 is low. The Sharpe ratios for the 3 and 5 years, 1.3 and 1.1, I think Dr. Brown would give us a good grade on that. On the information ratio, 0.37 is okay, not great, but I think, again, the 0.6 is 0.7, we get better marks on those ratios. The next page is just a very detailed page that show the endowment returns, again, over different periods, but broken out between the investment styles and the asset classes. What I would highlight is there's a few lines on here where we have really next to no assets. The third line down, credit related, more correlated and constrained credit related. We have, I think, $21 million, one manager in that strategy. In the less correlated, the real estate and the natural resources, we have next to no assets, that negative 55.7%, for example. In natural resources, that's $1 million that we have in one stock that is kind of orphaned. But in case you want to see lots of numbers on one page, there they are. On the next page, this is try to depict how we've done versus how we said we were going to do. So it goes back to 1996. The red line is what was projected. Every year, as part of our investment policy, we kind of indicate what we think we're going to earn, and that's that solid red line. The blue lines flaring out from that red line are 1 and 2 standard deviations. So two-thirds of the time, we'd expect to be within those smaller blue lines, and 95% of the time, we'd expect to be within the broader blue lines. The green line is what we've actually done. And the yellowish line is what the policy portfolio has done. So for the last 4 or 5 years, we had kind of been right on the green line, had been right on the orange line, the red line. It's dipped a little bit below it this past year. The green line is above the orange line or the yellow line, so that represents the value add from active management. But as you can see, we've had periods of being below and above the line, and over time, hopefully, we stay equal to or above that red line in what we do.
I'm sorry, Bruce, just for clarification, your projection includes value add or not? Is that
not
projection
really.
On policy?
It's really the policy portfolio without value add. Thank you for that clarification. The next page shows Tim the returns from the endowments versus potentially alternative portfolios. The green line is the S&P 500. We've just been in large U.S. stocks. And again, if we would have simply done that as of today, we'd be better off. For $100, we'd be at $462 versus the $426 in the portfolio. This, of course, doesn't take into account volatility, much more volatility in the stock market. But if you would have stuck with it, as of today, you'd be better. By the way, you would have been better in the tech boom of 99-2000, not so good in the tech crash. And then you would have closed the gap substantially right before the financial crisis, but would have suffered much more greatly during and that right after the financial crisis. The orange lines, the 60-40 portfolio, where we have vested, and then the lower lines are a global bond or U.S. intermediate bond and a short-term treasury bond.
Bruce, if I can, forgive my ignorance here, but you know, when you go back to page 7 here, and you talk about the value add from 3.79 to 4.51, and that's a value add. Then when you look on page 8, then the difference between the S&P 500 and what UTEMCO's endowment returns, is that a negative value add? I mean, does that mean that...
It means,
so how do you reconcile what your policy benchmark was and what we think the value add is relative to what the S&P has done and our portfolio has done?
We have a diversified portfolio. We're not 100% in stocks.
Okay.
The page 7 shows what our actual return has been versus our diversified portfolio if you wouldn't have had any UTEMCO staff, if you would have been in bonds and stocks and real estate, natural resources. That's what that kind of yellow line is.
Right.
No,
I got that.
On the next page, it is the case that if we would have just been in stocks, U.S. stocks, and nothing but U.S. stocks, where we sit today, we would have been better off. We'd be better off. But it has been a much wilder ride. And over time, it has generally been the case, the blue line has generally been above the green line, indicate that this balanced portfolio does tend to pay off. And you certainly don't have the kind of roller coaster ride. So, but yes, where we sit today, had we been entirely in the S&P 500, large cap U.S. stocks, we'd be better off than where we are now.
You and I have talked about this before, but how do you compare yourself to the Yales or the Harvards or the others relative to your value add compared to their value add, you know, normalizing the amount that's in the endowment?
We have to read tea leaves. We try to do it. Number one, we try to do it. It's a little bit like reading tea leaves because we don't get a lot of information out of other endowments. As a public endowment, everybody sees everything we do, but as private endowments, we don't see what they do. As best we can determine, our value add is about average for the top largest universities. As best we can determine, for those universities that have posted top quartile type returns, they are generating more value add than we are. Now, we think that part of that is because they have larger venture capital portfolios, which not only has historically given provided greater returns, but if you get the right, on average, but if you get the right venture capital partners, if you pick the right venture capitalists, you really do better than the average. And so a lot of the potential to add value can depend on which capital market you're investing in. It's a little bit conjecture because we don't have good data on it, but we try to look.
First, real quick, before we get off this page. So from 96 to 02, UTEMCO, and I know this was sometime before your time, but underperformed relative to the S&P in a kind of a 60-40 split. You then had a nice run of outperformance, really from 02 all the way through 013, and then the markets caught up with you. Why did we underperform so much in the 96-02 time frame?
You know, Russ was here then. Do you remember?
Yeah, I think it'd be fair to say if you went back to the 96-02 period, we were running a much different model at that point. We had primarily internal management. It was heavily U.S.-based. Really, we were going stop-start on any sort of private investing. It was very limited.
I mean, you were effectively public equities and fixed income for the most part.
Yes.
Really, no hedge funds, or really no
privates.
And hedge funds would have lagged. Hedge funds would have lagged in this bull market. And part of what I think, well, this is just the equity market.
But yeah, we were running a very different model than we run today. It was more similar to something you might have seen in some of the pension funds, large pension funds here in town. Mm-hmm. And it was not as successful. We were not engaging the best managers that we could find.
Okay, great.
You know, Bruce, it might be worth noting as well in terms of up-down capture, the way you design the portfolio is inherently conservative in the sense that you're only going to get about two-thirds of the up. I'm sort of doing this out of memory. In equity markets, but you only experience one-third of the down. So over time, that's a very good trade. So if you see, Mr. Chairman, where UTIMCO lags the market, it's during the uptime. So most of that period you mentioned from 96 was the tech bubble. And then when the market crashes, you see that's when UTIMCO's portfolio moves ahead. So in some sense, that's a policy the board set with their asset allocation.
Jeff, it was also during that time that we were changing the constitutional amendment to make us a total return fund as opposed to a fund that just paid out current dividends and interest only.
I see. Good. All right, thank you.
The next page, 16 in Diligent, page 9 in the paper copy. On the left, what we do is we assess the relationship between our portfolio and different broad capital markets. So the equities, these would be global equities, and what it says is for every dollar movement in equities, we'd expect to move 65 cents. For U.S. equities, 57 cents. Interest rates, if interest rates go down, we'd expect to go up. And currencies, the same thing. This is a measure of the diversification in the portfolio. I think a lot, particularly a lot of large pension funds and even portfolios that are even 60-40 stocks and bonds would see much larger, much higher equity betas. So it's just another statistical measurement of our diversification. On the right, it shows what various capital markets return during the calendar year. The first three bars are the bond market, global bonds, U.S. bonds, and then high-yield bonds were all negative. The gray bars are the commodities, broad commodity basket, oil, and gold. The blue bars are the equity markets, and so you can see S&P was up 1.4, Japan was up 8.9, Europe was down 6.8. And then the bars to the right are the emerging market public equities, which other than China were all down. So you can see most capital markets were down in calendar year 2015. If we would have put all the money in the topic in the Japanese stock market, we would have been really smart, but we didn't do that. And I actually think I read that pork bellies or lean hogs were the number one capital market. So we'd even be smarter if we would have put $25 billion in lean hogs. We didn't. Actually, I forgot. The next page is the one that I thought it was later on that Keith referenced. This is our up capture and our down capture. And we're up to 233 months now of data, and 140 of those months were up. So we split the 140 between the 70. No, that's a different chart. This we split it between U.S. and all world. And it's relatively the same numbers, but we capture about 61% or 66% of the ups and then suffer 36 to 41% of the downs. The next page shows where we have or haven't added value as a result of active management. Most of what we do is partnering with our external managers. And so during 2015, the long-only book was up. We added 36 basis points. This is less than what we had added in previous years. In the hedge fund book, it was up 50 basis points again, or we added 50 basis points value again less. Our private market book actually began to turn positive. I think part of it is because, going back to the question, Phil, I think you asked, what was the private book 8 years ago? We've been building it up. So it's been a, it's an immature or unseasoned portfolio. The drag that presents on returns is that the way private equity works is we'll make a commitment to a fund. We'll agree to invest $100 million with a partner. They start charging fees. So they'll charge $2 million a year to pay for their operating expenses. And they have 4 to 5 years to invest that money. So we've committed $100 million, but they don't invest all $100 million right away. They may call $20 million in the first year and $20 million in the second year and $20 million in the third year. So that, it takes a while to invest that money. All the while, the fee meter is ticking. So our returns are actually negative in the early years because they've invested the money at cost, but we're paying fees. When it works right, those early investments begin to pay off. They get marked up. Or they get monetized at gains, and that's when the returns kick in. So it's called the J curve because literally if you're looking at your return over time, it's negative, 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 and then hopefully gets positive, positive. So an unseasoned portfolio will have lower returns than a more seasoned portfolio, everything else being equal. So I think that might be one of the dynamics. We have done some tactical allocation. We didn't do much of it this past year. We had done more of it, particularly the gold, in previous years. We had also, a number of years ago, coming out of the financial recession, used derivatives to hedge against less likely but potentially catastrophic events or very negative events, and we haven't done as much of that. So that's how you get to the 74 basis points. When I mentioned...
What's gold now as a percentage of the portfolio?
Less than 2%.
Less than 2%.
And we're a little underweight policy. Our policy is 2.5. And
so in absolute terms, that's how much?
About $500 million. Well, because we have some in the ITF. So
about $600 million.
$600 million.
Yeah. It may be, because it's rallied the last week or so, it may be up to 2%. But we're about 50 bips under.
We're a little over in cash. So when we think about the gold, we also kind of think about what cash do we have. The next page shows where we are underweight and overweight. Nothing tremendous, nothing real dramatic in the middle, the natural resources MCC, that 2.2% underweight, that is gold and commodities. We brought the commodity book down substantially. Where we're a little overweight is in the private investments, and so we've underweighted the public investments to balance that off. If I could jump to page 23 in diligence 16, 16 in paper, what I wanted to do next is kind of talk about the overall portfolio and two dimensions. The horizontal axis is what have the returns been? Were they positive or were they negative? What were the absolute returns? And then the vertical axis on the left is, did our portfolio do better than the market on average? Did we add value or not? So the top right quadrant is where you always want to be, positive returns and value add. And you never want to be in the negative left, the bottom left, where you not only lost money, but you lost more money because of our efforts. And then, obviously, I think we'd rather make money, even if we didn't add value, than lose less money because we added value. And so if we go back on the next page, if we go back over 5 years, this shows the percentages of the portfolio that were in the various quadrants. The good news is the biggest bubbles, and the bubble represents the amount of assets, the size of assets. So the good news is only 5% are on the left. 95% of the portfolio had positive returns over the last 5 years. And we drew that dotted line in to say, well, you know, what we really are in the business of is earning an investment return equal to the distribution rate plus inflation, which was 6.2%. And so if you add the 48% bright green bubble and the 17% light green bubble, 65% of the portfolio achieved that earnings hurdle. But we had another 30% that was positive but didn't deliver as much. If you look at the value add, 68% of the portfolio added value and 32% underperformed. That's 5 years. The three-year number doesn't look a whole lot different if you look on the next page. The numbers are slightly different. We're up to 11% of the portfolio that lost money on the left, but 89% of the portfolio made money. And again, 67% of the portfolio beat that, what was now a 5.75% distribution rate plus inflation. So 3 to 5 years, you know, in the ballpark. The next page, calendar year 2015, it's not as positive a picture. Almost half the portfolio lost money. Just over 51% of the portfolio made money. So that's why we were able to make 41 basis points. We still had two-thirds of the portfolio where we added value, 68%, and 32% of the portfolio where we didn't add value. So those ratios stayed pretty constant. Part of the unfortunate, or part of what brought us down, was we only had 24% of the portfolio that was able to make more than the distribution rate plus inflation. The next page just is the same two-by-two, but it shows 15 different investment strategies. If you remember that second page we looked at with all the different asset classes and the three different investment styles, we have 6 rows, 3 columns, 18 cells. And I mentioned that we have 4 of those cells where we don't have any money. We don't have any private investment grade. We don't really have any hedge funds that are in real estate or natural resources. We really don't have any long-only credit. So that we're down to 14 cells. But in our private developed country, we split that between venture capital and lower middle market buyout, essentially. So we have 15 investment strategies that you're seeing on page 20. The orange are the privates. The blue is the long only. The purple is the hedge funds. And so now what I'd like to do is ask my colleagues to spend time with you going through each of these 15 investment strategies and talking a little bit about what we're doing and how they perform. So we start with the bad news, which is those investment strategies. This is for 1 year, calendar year 15, where we both had negative returns and negative value add. And so we've got to turn again to our longest standing colleague, now standing, Russ Campy. Tell us a little bit about the investment grade fixed income book.
Yes, thank you, Bruce. If you'll turn to the left-hand side of the page, you see the makeup of our internal or our investment grade fixed income portfolio. That's been fairly stable over the past several years as far as makeup, with 30% in the internal, which is a U.S. dollar based portfolio, 41% in our two global managers, Brain and PIMCO, and approximately 29% in Colchester and FIA. On the right-hand side.
I may have missed it, but the $3.7 billion, this is both the endowment and the ITF.
Yes, sir.
So if you go back to that two-by-two, you will only see about $2.5 billion or a different number.
That's right. And since the ITF is an asset allocation of approximately $3.5 billion, it's a substantial portion of our overall portfolio. So if you turn to the right-hand side, you have our investment returns, and I direct you to the value add row. 2015 was definitely a difficult year for us from a value add perspective. In fact, more than all that negative value add was during the last 6 months of the year. That's our first negative value add year since 2008. And it was a very difficult last 6 months of the year. Money flew from basically all fixed income markets that were outside of Europe, core Europe, U.S., and Japan. When he flew into those markets, their currencies outperformed versus U.S. dollar and the emerging markets where we were over. So that provided the negative value add. I think you'll see, if you look in the 5 and 7 year time periods, the value that we have added using the strategy. And if I can take you down to the information ratio row, once again, it was a difficult year, but over the longer term, we have added value. And the nice thing you know, we go through a difficult year, and everybody goes through difficult years. Fortunately, I think the things that we are going to take from this year and the lessons we're learning are that we need to be more cognizant of global financial market conditions. There wasn't a U.S. recession. Those are the times when we'd pull our horns in more. But unfortunately, the global economy was much rockier during, particularly the last 6 months of the year. But we do have dry powder, and we are in a position to allocate to some of our managers who do take more risk in the market. And so we're looking for places to do that in the coming year.
You know, I would say over longer periods of time, if you see the 2.3%, 5 years, 4.6%, 7 years, you know, I think our long-term projection is that we would earn 3%. I don't know, 3-4% in this book.
I think when you take into account the value add, sir.
The value add. And we're right, the benchmark's lower than that. But right. And then if you look at those volatility numbers, you know, around 4-5% volatility. So not a real volatile book, pretty steady eddy. We expect to earn something, but it's not going to be enough to distribute 5% and keep up with inflation.
Part of the reason, as you look at the allocation between our managers, we are trying to keep standard deviation similar to the benchmark. We're not trying to run a high beta portfolio. We want to try and take the appropriate risk. So,
Russ, where does duration stand versus the benchmark, both going into this year and as you complete the year?
As you came out of the year, our duration versus the benchmark was about 0.8 less. I would say on
average. So to define that, the benchmark is about.
The benchmark was about 6.6. The
portfolio years.
Was around 5.8. That was fairly steady throughout the year.
Bruce, how do you think about the next 5 to 10 years of what you expect, what you and the staff expect, and how that's communicated to the regions? And you know, we've had a lot of input from a lot of our managers. Some of our big macro managers think it's going to be a lot lower, given where kind of global credit is, where global equities are, and what the debt overhang is, and kind of reduction of inflation. So, how are you thinking about the next 5 years of kind of expected returns?
Bruce, if you don't mind.
No, I'd love, please, Russ.
Right, sorry. Yeah, Russ, let me address.
I'd love to address it. You know, Kyle, you have fixed income background. And it's hard to get away from the yield.
Yeah.
Well, the yield of the benchmark is about 2%. So as you look out the next 5 years, you're going to center somewhere around 2%.
That's why I asked the question.
And I think with the value add, I think that we can provide. You know, you come back to around the 3-3.5%.
That's a lot. I was waiting to see what he was going to sign up for value add. That's good value
add. So your value add is 50% over the benchmark.
I think that
that's incredible.
I think that our manager mix, and I think as we refine our process even more, that's the kind of thing that we are targeting. That's what we hope.
I might sandbag. I just wrote down what Russ said. I'm going to remember that.
And that's you, Russ, and then I'd like to hear from Bruce on the corpus.
if we can achieve 1.5 value add, and by the way, over 7 years, these guys have achieved 2.2 value add. But I think typically in this kind of portfolio, if you get 50 basis points value add, you're doing pretty well. Now, I'll take the 1.5. One wouldn't be horrible. I do think it's going to be very low. And we're going to hear from Ray Dalio tomorrow. And, you know, I think he's as knowledgeable about these things as anybody in the world. And I think he's going to, and I'll ask him, and I think he's going to tell us our expectations should be pretty low about this. We've kept this portfolio fairly steady in size. It is kind of the cushion. So to make sure we have liquidity for our distributions and for our capital calls, this doesn't include the cash, I don't believe. And we're sitting on a couple percent cash right now, which isn't earning anything. Again, so we don't so we have some, so playing a little defense and having some dry powder. Yeah. Slightly above nothing, almost. And we'll hear from Rob Kaplan tomorrow, and my guess, we'll see what he has to say about what the Fed's going to do. But expectations for this part of the portfolio will be low returns. And as we go through other parts of the portfolio, I think it'd be a good question as to what do we expect. And I think in general the theme is, you know, likely lower returns, certainly over the next 3 to 5 years. 10 years is a little hard to look out that far. And it's because there's been so much monetization. It has driven asset prices up. And it is hard to imagine that we'll have a tremendous amount of, given that we're still working off a lot of debt, we'll have a tremendous amount of growth, or that we can, you know, risk premiums can shrink any more than they've already shrunk. So we're very concerned, very cautious.
Thank you.
And at the Regents meeting, I think Jeff asked the question, kind of emphasized exactly this point, and then I think he told me that we should produce a lot of value add, if I remember correctly. That's his conclusion.
He told me to put it on oil.
Okay. Okay, thank you. The next part of the portfolio is the natural resources portfolio. And Spencer's going to...
Bruce, just a question. You know, we typically look at things on a 1, 3, 5, and 10-year tranche.
Yes.
Why do we look at a 7-year tranche?
Did, because, great, thank you for asking the question. We didn't... I mentioned that we're looking at 15 different investment strategies.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't cut the book like this until I got here 8.5 years ago. So we don't have the... we'd have to go back and recast, which Joan can do. We no, she can't do it. Jeez. It would be... We'd literally have to go back kind of, not security by security, manager by manager for the year and a half before I got here, but we didn't look at the portfolio like this at all. That's why we don't have 10 years.
So next year we'll see 8.
If you keep me around for a year and a half, we can get you 10.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Well, something to look forward to.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. So if I can point you to the chart or the table on the right-hand side of the natural resources private equity slide, you'll see that there's negative actual returns on a one-year basis for the portfolio. And while the natural resources private equity portfolio has outperformed the general private equity benchmark, it has maintained long-term positive returns, even in the face of very significant drawdowns in the global resources markets. In addition, I would point to the specific benchmark where we're looking at relative to the Cambridge Associates Natural Resources Private Equity Index. The natural resources private equity portfolio has significantly outperformed in all time periods. Our natural resource team believes that this outperformance relative to the Cambridge Associates benchmark is really due to a global and sector diversified index relative or portfolio relative to the benchmark.
Let me interrupt you 1 second. I failed to explain. We have a general benchmark and a specific benchmark. The general benchmark is all private investments, and that's what is in our investment policy statement. And because all of us operate as a team, we have kind of a single benchmark for all our private investments, whether they be natural resources or real estate or venture capital or credit or buyout. And that's what the general benchmark is, and that is our official benchmark, and we want to show that. And so you can see sometimes, but what we also wanted to show is as we've gotten a diversified private investment portfolio, how does each part of that portfolio perform against a more specific benchmark that is germane to that part of the portfolio? So I forgot to explain that.
Thanks for the clarification.
That's a policy level issue, right? In terms of what the benchmark is.
Yes, we talked. We went over this. We made this decision. The board and the Regents made this decision about a year and a half ago, after about a year of study, where we just settled on a general benchmark.
So what's the mandate for the natural resources team versus the private credit? Do they are they supposed to manage toward the specific?
No. Well, so as a total, so we as a total team manage to the general benchmark. That's the total fund. As part of the compensation program, individual teams have a portion of their compensation tied to their performance versus the specific benchmark. So it's a combination of both.
Yeah, but what I would say, Keith, is we don't manage to a benchmark. I mean, we put the specific benchmark in there because the relative performance to the general benchmark doesn't tell you that much. This tells you, hey, if you look at just natural resources, private equity stuff, how are you doing? And it's really just there to give you better information so you can get a better sense of relative performance.
The specific benchmark takes the beta out. Because so you'll see in some years, so for example, in this portfolio, in 7 years, they beat the general benchmark by 3%, specific benchmark by 8%. For 3 years, they actually trailed the general benchmark, but they beat the specific by even more. So what's going on there is how does natural resources relate to credit or real estate or private equity? So, again, I wish that we try to give you a lot of information, a lot of different optics into the portfolio. I have not concluded that there is a single number that will tell everything.
Yeah, no,
so
fair
that's
enough.
That's why we prefer to kind of provide more information and, you know, tease out as much in the way of observation as possible.
I just don't know what natural resources could have done to close the gap to the general benchmark more than they did.
Not this year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the market went down.
So, I mean, that looks like an ugly number, but they actually, as I look at it, outperformed, you know, relative to if you had indexed that specific asset class.
I share that observation.
Hey, Mark, given how much energy, whether it was upstream, midstream, or service, dropped last year, mining and ag, a 9% return is, a 9% loss is a massive victory the way that I see it.
I appreciate that. No, it is. So look, yeah, as you saw earlier when in the market slide, commodity markets are down anywhere from sort of 30 to 70%, depending on what market you want to pick. 2015 was maybe two-thirds of the correction. It started in 14, obviously. But for our book to be down 10%, you know, we feel really good about that. I know it's a negative number. I understand that. But if you look at the 5 to 7 year number, we're actually compounding at significantly positive numbers. Look, it could get marked down more this year. What I will tell you is it's very diversified, it's very global, and it's a lot more than what most people think of when they think resources, they think energy. This includes power development in Asia. It includes infrastructure in Latin America. It includes agriculture investments that are really unique, I think, in our portfolio. So it's much different than what most people think when they think of resources. It's not levered, and our partners didn't write stuff up. And so the markdown hasn't been as dramatic. So I appreciate the comment. We don't ever want to see a red number, but on a relative basis, we feel very good about where the portfolio is.
And Friday afternoon, our resources panel will have energy, mining, and agriculture. And we have another panel, just infrastructure.
You'll see some of our partners live and get to hear the strategies, and hopefully it helps put a little color in this.
And the specific benchmark, is that weighted by this asset allocation, or is it how?
No, it's not. It's not. So it's mostly energy. It's, I want to say, 85% energy, 10% mining, 5% ag. So it's a much different mix than ours. It's much more energy heavy.
It's kind of what Cambridge collects, and they're individual funds. They're not fund of funds.
And we think 50% for energy is about right for the overall portfolio. We don't think.
And again, that energy is upstream, midstream, downstream, and it's global. So Spencer was probably just getting to the bottom right-hand side.
No, you're good. I think this is a good conversation. So the one additional point that I wanted to make, I think is really important, is the natural resources investment portfolio has about $1.9 billion in unfunded commitments, which we believe will have an opportunity to deploy during what could be a very optimal time in the natural resources cycle. So we've had lots of conversations with our managers, and they believe that there's significant opportunity to deploy it.
We go into a lot of detail regularly on this portfolio. Part of my takeaway is, and Mark and Spencer, Billy, correct me if I'm misremembering this, but some of our mining, some of our individual, in general, our mining funds are okay. I mean, when I, you know, good. Some of the individual mining investments aren't great. And the issue here is how much debt do they have on them, and do we lose our equity? But, you know, other than that, very few of our investments have much in the way of debt. The equity isn't necessarily isn't at risk. It may take us longer to get less money than we had hoped for, but I don't think we're going to lose capital. Am I remembering that, summarizing that reasonably?
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, I mean, I think it's a big global headwind. I don't think we're going to suffer significant write-offs because we're not levered. What I think it's going to do is it's going to push exits out to the right, and it's going to suppress returns on what's in the ground. Now, to Spencer's point, we have a great partner network, and it's much different than it was 5 or 7 years ago. So in the last correction, we didn't have the kinds of partners that could get money to work. We have partners that are getting money to work now. You know some of them. They're calling money as we speak, and it's going into the ground, and we have the opposite of the J curve that Bruce was talking about because we're doing a lot of co-investing where there's no fees. We're investing right alongside our partners. So rather than having that fund drag, we're getting money right in the ground and good assets. And so I think during this part of the cycle, we're going to get money in the ground such that even though some of our existing investments get pushed out to the right, the new investments are going to more than make up for that. So it depends a lot on what the recovery looks like, but we feel really, really good about it.
Okay. The next page is the long-only natural resources portfolio.
So the long-only natural resources portfolio book really consists of public equities and commodities, and the strategies are very unique, so I'm going to speak to each separately. For equities, our smaller cap growth-oriented portfolio underperformed relative to a larger cap oriented index over the 18-month drawdown in the natural resources equity markets. The underperformance essentially turned historical actual returns and value add negative from positive. So that's something that we've seen happen recently. On the commodity
side, interrupt. A couple of years ago when we were looking at this, there was a ton of green on the page.
Yeah.
There was positive absolute returns, positive value add. I mean, we were flying high, and now we know what it's like to be grounded.
Now we're in the double red box. So for the commodities, our customized, actively managed strategy significantly underperformed the index as well during the 18-month period drawdown. For context, our commodity manager took a very fundamental bottom-up approach to portfolio construction, which essentially resulted in an overweight energy, underweight ag complex, and he basically took the trade of the platinum complex over gold. And that, those positions essentially resulted in significant underperformance for the portfolio over the 18-month period. Because of our discomfort with the positions he took, as well as the significant negative roll yield, we decided to redeem a significant portion of the commodity portfolio. As Bruce and Mark mentioned earlier, so about 60% of the commodity portfolio was redeemed, and basically that leaves us about 200 basis points underweight for commodities.
And the commodity exposure we have now is passive.
No, it's active.
Still active.
It's active. But it's a much more constrained strategy.
Yeah. We have two strategies with them.
Yeah. I mean, look, the because of the way the commodities futures markets are structured right now, there's what we call a negative carry. They're in contango, meaning the curves are upward to the right in the future. And so every time you roll a contract, you're essentially compounding negatively. That's a pretty significant headwind, even if you're adding value. And we just felt like we were uncomfortable with our partners' positions. They had levered the portfolio and added beta, so he'd leaned into the correction, and we were at about 150% gross at the front end of the curve and eating that negative roll yield. And we just felt like that was the wrong place to be. When you had a fundamental disagreement with your partner, I think it's time. And then the asset class itself was just so poorly structured, we felt like it was just in the best interest of the endowment to go under policy. 200 basis points under policy is a pretty big move. We moved a lot of that into resource equities, a lot of that into yield-oriented resource equities. So if you want to think of it on just a fundamental basis, we traded a negative roll yield for a positive yield. So we think that was the right move. It's something we're going to have to deal with over time. You know, we're either going to have to change the policy or address the underweight or maintain the underweight, but we're very aware of it.
All right. Thank you, Spencer.
Can we ask a question about gold? How does the staff feel about the gold position and sizing and the global negative rates? Have we developed a view internally on how we view negative rates and how those affect gold and whether the gold position is sized properly?
We spend a lot of time talking about it. To the extent we've developed our view, it's manifests itself in the policy where we are now. We still have some gold, but we're underweight. This is a topic that we are talking about as much as any topic, which is another way of saying I don't know that we have general consensus across the staff. I'm not sure we've ever had general consensus across the staff on the gold.
It doesn't play to our strengths. You can't add value, right? So it's really the only not value add oriented portion of the portfolio. Arguably, just adding it to the portfolio could be an exercise in value add based on allocation. Gold has been an interesting experience for us. It's gotten a disproportionate amount of attention and discussion for what it is. I view it as essentially a diversification from a currency perspective. Anything that's not a U.S. dollar hasn't done really well. But it's also fundamentally a hedge, and it's a safe haven. And so we've seen it rally here early in 2016, not really, in my view, on fundamentals, but on more of a sentiment trade. So gold has been a tactical detractor from the portfolio since we've had it in there. But gold is one of those things, if gold is working, probably a lot of other things aren't working, as you know. And if you saw all of those markets that Bruce showed earlier, almost everything was down last year. Gold probably, I can't remember what it did in 15, but in 16 it's up. When equity and capital markets are under pressure, gold tends to outperform. So,
it's something we want to keep talking about. Part of our discussion is now kind of gold versus cash. You know, do we want to be in gold or do we just want to be in cash?
And we talk about peers a lot, and Bruce is going to show you some work on peers. I don't know of another peer that has gold in their policy portfolio.
And we own it in the physical.
We own both physical and
futures. No, we sold all the futures.
All physical.
Yep. All physical.
And so if the state of Texas creates the gold bank, then we would...
We have another place to keep it.
Wonderful. Real quick, what's your expected returns over the next 5 years? Private investments, natural resources.
Well, so what I would tell you is going into the correction, our 5 and 7 year numbers were kind of low mid-20s, 22-23% rate of return before the correction. I'd like to think we'll be north of 20 on a cross-cycle basis. In other words,
so 5 years north of 20.
Yeah. Yeah, once we're back in a...
Okay, I'm going to write that down, but then I'm going to put in the CIO haircut on that. And
well, I mean, look, our trailing 5-year number is almost 16%, right? And we're at the bottom of a pretty brutal cycle. Yes. So I'd like to think steady state we could be north of 20.
And how about the long-only national MCC?
You know, my view on that beta is, so the way that portfolio works for us, Jeff, as I think you know, is it's on that up-down capture. We do capture more of the ups than the downs, but not a lot more because we capture a disproportionate amount of the downs. So we capture 115% of the ups and 110% of the downs is one way to think about it. Look, I mean, my view is as good as yours or anybody else's on where that market's going. I think we're in the still third or fourth inning of a pretty big workout. So I don't necessarily see that whole complex coming back in the short term, but I think that when it does, it could come back pretty significantly. I mean, asset prices are very, very depressed there, as you know. I hate to put a number to that. I mean,
if we're going to get 15 to 16% in our private book with the illiquidity risk we're taking, in the public book, we ought to be around 9, 10.
And that includes the gold, which Which kind of skews
The gold is a whole different animal.
You might, anyway, it's an interesting place that you've got the gold in long only.
We thought we talked about do we put it in a fixed income board, but Mark wanted that,
that
gold
so
preference. Badly.
Yeah, of course he did. Returns would be good.
All right.
So nine.
Does the staff have the latitude to make the position larger than the policy portfolio?
Yes.
So in theory, you can drive value add. Versus
through tactical,
versus
yes,
the
from an allocation
yes, absolutely.
Policy. Absolutely, just to absolutely. The asset itself. It's
and by the way, over the last few years, that was a big detractor from value add because it wasn't in the we had the gold position, and it wasn't in the policy portfolio, and that cost us about 100 basis points of value add for a year for about 3 or 4 years.
And the correct one thing Mark said, he said it's always been a detractor since it's been in there.
No.
In the early days,
exactly
it was.
No.
True. In the early days, it was.
For the record.
We were brilliant.
We were brilliant
for the first
absolutely
few
right.
years. Speaking of brilliant, Ryan Reebsoff, and this credit portfolio is an interesting one in the hedge fund book.
So now we're decomposing the $10 billion hedge fund portfolio into four different segments. So just a brief summary of how we did overall. When global equities were down 2.5% and U.S. credit was down 5%, we were up 1% on the overall portfolio. The fund of funds were down about 40 basis points, so we feel good about the outcome. As we look at credit, this was down 3% on the year. The managers were down anywhere between 6 and up 20. In an environment where high yield was down 5%. And then we had one manager that was a little heavy in some levered equities and a little exposed to riskier credits, and they were down about 11%. So when you put all that in the blender, we were down 3%. So versus fund to funds, down 40 bips, we did not add value this year.
And again, I'm sorry, just like with private investments where we have a general benchmark, same thing for hedge funds. So Ryan mentioned there's 3 or 4 different strategies, long, short, or multi-strat, credit being one of them. So the general benchmark covers all the different hedge fund strategies.
Right.
But then the specific benchmark is specifically credit hedge funds.
Right. And so versus other credit hedge funds, we added 500 basis points. They were down 8. So as I think about 2015, it was really the higher the rated bond, the better performed, and the lower rated bond, the worse it performed. Your triple C, your defaulted securities were down 15 to 30%. And we all know what happened with the energy high yield as well. So we feel like overall it was an okay outcome. There was one manager that was frustrating. And over time, we have significant value add in this area. And to just summarize this portfolio for you, it's concentrated. Really, it's 5 managers that drive the bulk of the performance. It's a competitive area, so to have 10 managers doing similar things would be too much diversification in our mind. And really, it is stressed and distressed corporate bonds for the most part. You know, not all of them are in the high yield index. Some of them are defaulted or in the middle of bankruptcy. Others are trading at 70 or 80 cents on the dollar, and we think it's going to go back to par. And all these managers have between 10 and 40% of cash in their portfolios, given where they are in the cycle. So hopefully that context helps.
One of the managers, tomorrow morning, one of our panels is on credit-related fixed income. Jeff Aronson from Centerbridge will be presenting, along with Pete Brigger, who's in our private credit portfolio. So I think that'll be interesting. Now, we should have talked beforehand. We haven't practiced, but that's not going to stop me. Our Argentinian debt position.
Yes.
Is that in this portfolio or the private portfolio?
It is the bulk of this Owl Creek
that's what I thought.
Sliver here. And that was the top performer, about up 20%.
And we read in the news that settlements are being reached.
Yes.
So we think that will be good. That is a good outcome.
Yes, and it's in the process of healing. Payments are getting made. They want to, you know, they were at Davos. They want to enter the capital markets. So we feel like that thesis is playing out. So hopefully we can make another 10 to 20% from here in the next year. But
it's Argentina and it's not over. So
that was one of the early, we started making co-investments a few years ago. Mark kind of led that effort in natural resources. We've done it in private equity. You'll hear us talk about Yeti tomorrow. But with our hedge fund managers is another area where we have done it, the Argentinian debt being one.
Okay. Return next 5 years?
In just credit?
In this category. Hedge funds, credit-related fixed income.
So it's been a great area. You can see from the returns that it's, you know, the down part of the cycle. I think our managers will do a decent job preserving capital, and I think it's a really good opportunity set coming out of it. So I would call it mid to high single-digit net returns the next 5 years.
I agree.
Okay.
Thank you. Net of fees.
Everything's net of fees. So what, that's like 7 to 9?
We'll call it 7.5. How's that?
Okay. In hedge fund speak, it's just always adjectives. It's never.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, yes.
I
know.
Eddie Lewis, heading up real estate now.
That's right. So I've recently taken over the real estate portfolio, which is quite a privilege, and been with the firm for about 5 years, so it's an exciting time for me. Unfortunately, I have to lead off with a double red box, but we do have a double green box coming up, so which is a larger portion of our book. If we look at slide 26, diligent number 33, ended the year 2015 with $804 million of NAV in the real estate portfolio, so the MCC portion of the real estate portfolio. 2.4% of PUF and JEF, 2.8% of ITF, so slightly below policy of 2.5% and 3%. We have four managers, five different mandates. I think it's important to note, and we've spoken about this in previous board meetings, we've turned over 50% of the book in the last 18 months. That was done to address the box on the right, which is we have experienced underperformance against the benchmark over all time periods. We've had positive results over the long term, and we've had adequate returns, but in relation to the benchmark, we've been disappointed with how our portfolio has performed. Unfortunately, one of the newer managers we hired hasn't worked out so far, and we hired this manager because we knew they were a deep value add investor, and given where real estate had recovered in core markets, we felt there was frothiness in markets in tier one cities. We thought that a manager who had a deep value add bias, who looked for stocks that maybe had portfolios in secondary cities, would be an interesting position to be in to outperform. And this manager has not performed to date, so we've realized significant underperformance due to that. I'd say that we continue to evaluate the REIT book. It's top of mind to us. We are underweight the REIT book. I know Warner was talking about the natural resources book. We're underweight the REIT book to fund our private book because we think that's what we'll find the most returns. But as we look at this one, it's something we're evolving over the next few months. Take a look at.
What are your expected returns over the next 5 years?
You know, if I think about, so our opinion is that the real estate markets have become somewhat fully priced. I think when you look at REITs, you can look at the dividend component. So if we say that's 3%, and we say that, you know, you can get some capital improvement or adjustment in the capital values over that, another 3 or 4%. I think if you say that 6, 7%, if we can add 100 basis points of alpha, then I think 6 to 8% is an interesting return for the next 5 years for real estate.
What are you assuming as a 10-year rate? I mean, real estate's really affected by rates, right? So what's the
assumption? Yeah, I mean, I think our view and the view of many of our managers is that the 10-year rate will remain low for several months of time, and that spread between where the cap rates are today and where that 10-year rate is still historically high. So even if the 10-year end of the curve moved up, we'd still have significant cushion as to where real estate is traded relative vis-a-vis.
So am I hearing you right, saying it's going to stay right around here, 1.5 to 2%?
It may move up a little bit, but I think from a cap rate perspective, we still have significant cushion to absorb that. People still view real estate as an interesting alternative to in your treasuries or to the bonds, and I think they're willing to accept a lower risk premium than they have in the past.
I keep asking these questions about different asset classes because I'm trying to get a discussion going on whether the staff believes that negative rates will ever happen here and how that might affect the whole endowment in each of these classes. So I'd love to at some point in time hear the view from you, Bruce, and from the staff on, you know, if negative rates are something we're thinking about in the future.
We are thinking about it. It's not our base case yep. at this point. There is a reasonable probability, 20 in our view, 20-30% probability, could be higher. I had breakfast with Ben Bernanke last week with a small group of people. He was asked. He doesn't think that negative rates are an effective policy tool. He knows they exist now. He doesn't think they'll be effective. So he wouldn't encourage his ex-colleagues to follow that path. There are many other routes to easing monetary policy, even easier monetary policy than negative rates. And Bernanke, at least, was more in the camp that if we needed to ease further, we should do those. So it's something we think about. We look at the scenarios. It's not our base case at this point. Again, I'm going to ask Ray about it tomorrow, Ray Dalio about it tomorrow, Robert Kaplan. I don't know if he's got a speech prepared. I don't know if he'll take questions or not. And then Friday we'll have John Gray, the world's largest owner of real estate, talking to us. So it's a good question. And it's also, I think, a really good question. What do we expect to earn, whether we have negative interest rates or low interest rates over the next 5 years? Because I do think it's our view is more muted than what we, what markets have produced in the last 5 or 7 years.
I think an Uzi analysis, asset class by asset class, would be helpful for both the board and the client. Even if it's only a 20% chance, that's a pretty high chance that I would imagine no one around this table thought could even be possible 5 years ago. It's probably a sub-1 5 years ago. It's now 20 or 25, so maybe we should.
Well, that's my view, and I don't know.
Run that. I would concur with your view. We have some of the world's largest economies are there.
Oh, running them now, yeah.
And Europe's about to go further negative, and Japan just entered, and it's definitely a thought. If you read economists on the left and the right are advocates of negative rates, so we should start at least thinking about how it affects every asset class.
And it's interesting in Europe because of that we're seeing people buy private real estate, 2-3% cap rates, which is 5 years ago would have been unheard of. Even in core risk European real estate, it's incredible that capital values.
Yeah, I think the question of rate compression, many of us think is coming. But if you just took a negative rate today, starting tomorrow morning, and all things being equal, that's one scenario. That's not going to happen, right?
Yep.
If you took a negative rate, I mean, you have a tremendous value in any yield co, real estate, et cetera. The problem is what gets you to a negative rate. That's the problem. I'm hearing a lot of very good, and by the way, I love that one of the great things about our staff, they're working to make money for the client. So I'm not surprised to hear some good return projections. Hey, get off the board with all these good returns coming ahead. But I'd say on the heels of unprecedented global coordinated money printing, malinvestment everywhere in the world because nobody wants to earn zero, savers being punished, and a lot of disequilibrium, as economists would call it. I hope we have those returns going forward. They seem to be better returns than we've had with all the money printing going on. So I don't know. I personally have a question. By the way, I think in our staff here is so incredible and all that good stuff. But everybody knows what I think about the staff and the institution and the work ethic. I think that we are collectively in a business that may be as hard now as it's ever been. So that's a tribute to everybody in this room on staff and board. But I think it's as challenging as it's ever been to allocate long-term assets. I actually have this sneaking concern. We'll see what's said tomorrow. I have a feeling terms like disequilibrium and the marginal utility of debt, money printing being zero, if not negative, or it's a weird world out there, right? I have this fear, not for 50 years or the next 20 years, but for some period of time. My concern is, and I love hearing these returns, because it would be like having an athlete on your team that says, I don't think I can hit the ball. But, you know, put me in there. So I love the way our staff thinks about doing their job. That's one of the inspiring things about it and why I think we do so well. But I'd say a question could be asked is whether, while we're sitting here wondering how this disequilibrium sorts itself out, whether expected future average returns are all going to coalesce around zero in all asset classes. I don't know if that's for a year, or 3 years, 5 years. You hope it's not very long. By the way, the more you have volatility down, then the more you begin to correct those things. Yeah. Let's argue that the market and some dividend stocks are more attractive today than they were 90 days ago. So, but I think there's still a lot that's got to sort itself out. Scenario analysis is great. I think that should be done. If you told me we were going to have negative rates in the morning just by fiat, I'd say that makes everything that has a yield more valuable. If you told me what it is that's going to get us to negative rates, I'd say, hey, along the way, let me think about that, what that's going to do to all our assets. So a lot of things to think about in that scenario, but I think it's Uzi's job's pretty tricky. It's a long-winded way of saying I don't want to run that analysis. I'm not sure whether you assume everything drops in another 20 or 30%.
This is helpful input.
Kyle, do you have a thought on negative interest rates driving deflation further than having the opposite impact of being bleeding?
Yeah, it's clearly right what the people in Japan told you 2 days later. And that's a big fear. When you look at again, back to Uzi's job, and I know all of you have input. You know, he's done a great job kind of bringing in a couple of potential scenarios into the risk section, which we'll get into when we get to risks. But, you know, I think, again, the negative rate scenario and adding to Arden's comments, what would get us to negative rates is not a positive environment. And, you know, when you hear Ray speak tomorrow, as you know, I've worked with Courtney and Susan and Ryan a lot on couple of these things, and one of them is, I know what Ray's thoughts are because he's already sent them to us, and you already had a conference call February 25th, and the numbers, you know, are very close to, you know, twos and threes,
right,
max,
right,
over long terms, and he thinks they're going down, not up.
Real return or nominal return?
Real returns.
And that's what, and by the way, going back to this
because
year's investment,
inflation's coming in.
This, yeah, year's investment policy statement, I don't remember the exact numbers, but pre-value add, I think we were at about 3-point-something nominal. So, and maybe we're a little optimistic because we want to get put into bad. But, yes, we're not.
Getting value add in a deflationary environment is going to be interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or if we're in a loss environment,
mm-hmm,
and you're holding your own at zero.
Mm-hmm.
Had you trended towards zero on all asset class returns,
yeah,
you had value add and you held your own and protected the corpus.
Yeah.
Challenges is, you know, there's been all this talk about Fed, and we've talked in this room about it. Concerns over inflation. I think the Fed would love to get inflation, right?
Oh.
There's a fear of deflation, and
yeah,
it's been that way since 08.
Yeah.
That's why we printed the money.
Yeah.
So deflation is a killer. Inflation is what they'd like to get some of. They kind of got some of it in the wrong places. You get it in healthcare, you get it in, you know, other costs, but commodities for a while. But I'd say one of the things that gets missed, I think, is the hidden, probably of our time, deflationary force is technology.
Mm-hmm.
I tell my, every time me and my three boys talk about finance, the technology is every single day a margin killer, a deflationary tool, whether it's fracking, internet, robotics. And so we have this thing that can improve your life on the one hand, convenience, but is deflationary in and of itself every single day. And that's that. You add that to the picture, that's getting interesting.
So back to that question, you know, raise numbers to us. We can say these, right? I mean, as far as his expectations, 10-year expectations for bonds, 2%, 2.6. For stocks, is 3%. Mm-hmm. For cash, it's about 0.5%. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be, you know, when you look at the value add that, say, you know, the hedge fund teams brought us and what they're doing now, they've brought immense value add to our portfolio on even in rough years. And so it's going to take more and more alternative thinking to generate more and more kind of yield
returns,
excess returns. But I, you know, in this environment, and again, if we're headed to negative rates or at least, you know, following the rest of the world, it could create deflation. One of those environments is not in our, right? We have declining inflation as some of our risks, but we don't have deflation in one of our risk scenarios, and we should at least entertain it.
We'll look at it. All right, we've covered five of the portfolios. These were the bad five, for at least for the last calendar year, where we were both negative returns and negative value add. We'll try to pick up the pace a little bit. The next two are long-only public equity books, which this is the category where the returns were negative, but the value add continues to be positive.
Right. So during calendar year 2015, the MCC developed a three equity portfolio that generated negative actual returns with positive value add. The portfolio lost 40 basis points relative to the benchmark, which is MSCI World. Relative to the benchmark, lost 90 basis points to the benchmark MSCI World. The main detractors were poor relative performance by three of our U.S. managers, as well as poor relative performance from our Japan manager. And this was offset by strong performance from a few of our global managers. Our currency hedged regional weights to Europe and Japan, which did better than the U.S. Should note also that calendar year 2015 was a bit the tale of two halves. The first half of the year, return value add were both positive, and the second half of the year, return value add were both negative. So that resulted in a negative actual return and only positive value add for the whole calendar year. Over the longer term, the portfolio continues to have positive actual returns in the low to mid teens, and over the 3, 5, and 7 year periods of positive value add above 300 basis points. We continue to have 12 managers roughly allocated a third each across U.S., global, and ex-U.S. The next page is our emerging markets portfolio. During the calendar year, portfolio lost 6.5% compared to the MSCI VM. Benchmark loss at 14.9%. The primary contributors to relative performance were strong relative performance by our China A-share manager, as well as one of our Brazil managers and two of our Japan Asia managers. And we also benefited from out of benchmark exposure to the China A-share market. We now have 18 managers, and the portfolio is roughly 20% global emerging market managers and 80% regional and country specific managers.
And so, over the next 5 years, what do you think we'll learn here? It's a good question. I'll start asking that question.
Well, I think Jeff's on an exercise. He's penciling out.
But you can't highball it either.
Can you tell us what it needs to be to get to 8.5? Can you tell us?
There's no upside to this question.
Right, there isn't. Over a 5 year period, we would say 9 to 10% to develop the equity and maybe 12% for EM. EM, I think, is a bit binary. But to get to 10% for a developed country, you say dividend yields are about 2%, say 5% earnings growth, or you're not buying just the average company, you're buying companies that are taking market share, growing, and taking advantage of the dislocation, then maybe 2 or 3% from companies buying at the valuation. And then EM, if growth recovers,
great.
I shave a couple percent off each of that.
There's some secret sauce in here.
You know, it's amazing. The staff is so articulate and speaks with such specificity until you ask that question. And it's, mid to high, low. So it's very broad. But, Susan, once again, I continue to say your portfolio is just outstanding. I mean, your value add on long-only equities, 7 years, 330 dips, and then 280 on emerging market. Just really, really phenomenal.
So, and Amanda, you know, and Russ.
Yeah.
And remember, this was a portfolio 9 to 10 years ago that was losing a few hundred basis points.
So they really
and you're going to see a lot of their managers tomorrow and some Friday. Okay, we begin to get in the green area. Let's take our time now. We'll zip through. This is where, well, actually, we're not bright green yet. We had positive returns, yes. But at least against the general benchmark in emerging markets, we were still negative. Richard?
Yeah, so I'll be covering the, so I'm Richard Gohn, emerging markets privates here. So the private equity portfolio in emerging markets has an NAV of $982 million today as of year end, calendar year end, which is comprised of 20 managers, 29 funds, and two co-investments, and delivered a low but positive return of 1.3% for the past 12 months. Returns for the period were negatively impacted, as you can imagine, by foreign currency and commodity pricing declines, but partially offset by gains in Asian venture capital and growth equity investments that we have on the ground. The one-year period, we delivered a negative value add versus the general benchmark of 940 basis points, but a positive value add of 330 basis points versus the specific benchmark, which in this case is the Cambridge Associates Emerging Markets Private Equity Index. The negative variance on the general against the general benchmark is primarily due to the fact that the portfolio is fairly young, front season, probably a better word for that, and the fact that the general benchmark is comprised mostly of developed market funds, almost in its entirety, which our emerging market portfolio does not have any exposure to. As noted on the pie chart, the geographic composition of the portfolio is substantially weighted towards Asia, particularly China with 36% weighting. That's on NAV. If you factor in unfunded commitments and estimate the usage of these commitments that we've already made to our local partners there, Asia and China drops to 62% and 28% respectively, which is much more in line with their contribution on a GDP basis to the broader EM economy, or GDP pool. In the coming years, I mean, I would expect, I've been here for a year, and it's still pretty good portfolio. We're doing a lot of work. We're adding personnel for Asia. We're making structural adjustments on a geographic way, deepening the local partnerships, and placing a ton of emphasis on co-investments, which for us we think has tremendous value add, particularly because it's made on a no fee, no carry basis. So if you want to peg me to a number, I'd probably use the developed country private markets portfolio as baseline, which, if you look at our returns, which are on a few slides in the green section, that's 12-15% or so on average. I would expect to meet, not exceed those numbers over the next 5-7 years.
Again, the kind of the tools we might have, going back to the kind of Ray of 2% in bonds, 3.5% in stocks. So what tools do we have? We've talked a lot about value add, kind of beating the market on average. And another is illiquidity, taking on that illiquidity risk. Again, there's no guarantee, just because you take on that risk, that you're going to get rewarded for it, but that's our job, to try to make that happen.
Yeah, and I think it's evident that this portfolio has had a lot of headwinds from currency, obviously. And so in local currency, we've had some great investments. And obviously on a dollar basis, we suffer that drag. You know, our partners tend to underwrite currency depreciation in their investments. So they'll underwrite 3-5% a year currency depreciation on a 5-year, 7-year hold period. But when a currency drops 50% in a year, you're obviously not gonna catch that. You can't really hedge it. I think, and what's I think important to remember is our partners get paid on US dollar basis. So they suffer the returns, you know, the consequences, as do we. So they're heightened. They have a very heightened awareness of this. We talk to them all a lot about it, and we try to get a really good sense of what that means on the ground in each economy. A lot of our partners are pan. You know, we have partners that are pan regional, so they're covering not just one country but multiple countries, multiple currencies. That's a lot of idiosyncratic risk to process. But what I would tell you is we would certainly expect the currency headwinds to be less in the next 5 years than they have been in the last 5 years.
I think you'll hear that tomorrow on our emerging markets panel. We have three of our managers $700 million dry powder committed to these managers right now receive dislocations across the board in sectors and geographies, as Mark said. That makes it a very compelling asset class right now to be involved with, much like the natural resource private portfolio.
Have any of our managers in China or Asia more generally experienced any fraud in their portfolios?
Not as far out. Nor in Brazil.
Private credit.
So I have taken this over from Scott Bigham. He and I have worked closely together since 08 as part of the credit committee across the firm, and we're in the process of hiring a senior investment professional to work with me to manage not only the hedge fund credit relationships with these you see here. And the way to think about this portfolio is typically longer duration than the hedge fund credit horizon, but not nearly as long as the private equity horizon. So kind of 3-4 year time frames, you know, it's not the 5 and 10 year kind of stuff. They're really underwriting high teens for the most part, in the right part, really the trough of the cycle, if they are able to do more buyouts, more distress for control, more restructurings, they can shoot for 20s. And again, that's gross a fee, and they don't all bat 1,000. So, you know, they've achieved that, but net a fee, the 7-year number, is about 14%. And so from here, I probably expect, you know, 10 to 13% the next 5 years because of where we are in the cycle. But if you give me longer, then my return expectations would be higher. And I would just point out that in this area, you know, the multiple of money isn't as big as it is in private equity, you know, with the shorter holding period as well. So a lot of times this is 1.3 to 1.5 times multiple, you know, 1.7, 1.8 on the high end, 2 in the best vintage years, but it's not the 2.
This is a portfolio that was probably closer to $2 billion. We built it up in 08, 09, probably got up to about $2 billion. It's running off. We've committed very little capital to it.
Yep.
Over the last few years,
yeah,
because of where the cycle is.
It's half the size it was at the peak. It's about 3.5% of the endowments. And, you know, again, 6 or 7 managers really matter, and really 2/3 of the portfolio is with the top 3. And to Bruce's point, we have $350 million unfunded, and that's really with 3 managers. And the bulk is, you know, Centerbridge and Treeline. And so this is, you know, I mentioned restructuring and distress for control. It's also buying non-performing loan portfolios at a discount. It's direct lending. It's really, you know, it's very good risk-adjusted returns is how we think about it. So Pete Brigger and Jeff Aronson will talk about it.
Pete's with Fortress. Jeff is with Centerbridge.
Yep.
All right, we get into the really better stuff now. Ryan, are you gonna let Courtney talk about the $8
billion? Nope, I am also doing that.
Now take the victory lap.
You'll see Courtney in a second. So by design, this is our biggest area of the hedge fund portfolio. It's $8 billion of the 10. Part of the reason for that has been the favorable view on developed markets versus emerging. The other aspect is these managers are larger and more able to scale for us, as it's hard to get capacity. As Courtney will point out, other parts of our portfolio are even more capacity constrained, and therefore, even if people like to double their size, we just can't. And it's also a very high conviction area for us. As you see from the returns, it's been 1.5% last year and anywhere, you know, kind of high single digit the last 3, 5, and 7 years. The outperformance is also very strong and consistent. And really, the way we think about the performance here is, you know, cash plus a 0.3 beta to the markets plus our alpha. So what we've seen over the last, you know, 10 years is they've taken our return from cash away, so that's reducing returns. I hope Susan's right on those equity forecast numbers because we'll get 0.3% of that, or, you know, 0.3 of that. If it's a little less than that, I'm not expecting it to contribute much from the beta. And So therefore, the majority of our return is always driven by the alpha. But we may, to Arden's point, we may only have the alpha, you know, driving the returns over the next 5 or 10 years, depending on the environment. So we've historically had, you know, 400 or 500 basis points of alpha. And so that's what I feel really good about. And then if we get some cash in there and we get some positive beta contribution, then the numbers will go higher. But that's how we think about the building blocks returns. And as you see from the pie chart, it's really 70% long short equity, where it's all about the spread of their stock picking, not the beta. And it's really multi-strat and event-driven that's really focused on the outcomes of the values that they're isolating, more of a trading strategy.
All right. I'm going to try to keep us going. The private developed country.
Thank you. So I just took over this portfolio from Scott Bigham as well. In 2015, our private equity portfolio returned about 12.6%. When you compare that over the past years against our general benchmark, we underperformed for most periods, but outperformed last year by 1.9%. And I want to remind you that the general benchmark does include multiple private asset classes. So if you look at our relative underperformance, you could really attribute it to areas like venture and real estate that outperform private equity during those years. Looking at the specific benchmark, this is a general global private equity benchmark that we think more closely resembles our portfolio. We outperform that benchmark in almost all periods except for the trailing 7-year period. And if you look at our recent outperformance both against the general benchmark and the specific benchmark, we would attribute that actually to a shift in strategy that we undertook several years ago to target managers in the lower middle market, small buyout segments of the private equity market. And really going forward, we think we'll continue to generate outperformance through those managers.
Pat was kind enough to take over this portfolio 2 months ago, and appreciate it. Do a great job here. And then real estate, Eddie.
Yeah, so the private real estate book, and just to level set, we have $1.5 billion of NAV in the private real estate book. That's about double the size of our MCC real estate portion of our book. Very quickly, as you can see, the one-year numbers, nearly 19% return, value add of over 800 points over the private equity fund-to-fund benchmark. Everybody's talking about specific benchmark, so against the Cambridge real estate, almost 400 basis points of value add in the year. 3-year, also really strong numbers. And I think if we look at our trailing 5 and 7, we underperformed the benchmark in those years. But as Bruce mentioned at the start of the board meeting, 7 years ago, we didn't have a real estate portfolio. And so extremely unseasoned, big J curve effect. But as the portfolio has gotten more mature, we've really started to lift our value back.
And so, I mean, exceptional returns, obviously, over multiple periods. What's your expectation going forward? You talk on the public side about kind of the dividend plus some capital appreciation. Where you've got an illiquidity issue here in fees, except what do you think the return will be?
Yeah, I think real estate is in an interesting time for the markets. The real estate values have appreciated considerably. In the private real estate book, we tend to take on assets that have some problems, dysfunction, whether they are under lease or there's an ownership issue, and we expect to get paid for that. So you won't really get a dividend component on it, so we really think that we're going to create value through NOI growth and through capital value. So I think for us, if we feel like in a pretty difficult market where capital values are pretty high, we're at low to mid double digits, so that's a pretty good return. 500 to 600 basis points over what we think we could earn.
How do you think about the difference between kind of the long only MCC real estate book and the private real estate book? Is the private book investing in smaller deals, and that's why we're kind of seeing kind of much larger numbers compared to like public REITs at a 2 or 3% dividend?
Yeah, so we are investing in smaller deals. We're also being tactical about how we invest. One of the things that we really like to do is we like to buy assets that are broken, and we like to do something to fix them so that the core market, which is a remarkable client, and we found that we could create tremendous value by doing that, and that's where we have been able to generate a lot of our value add.
The public market's core real estate. The private market tends to be more value and opportunistic. And as Eddie mentioned, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, we had no private real estate equity. All we had was the core. And so the long-term strategy has been to increase the private, the value add, the opportunistic, where we can make more money and bring down the core. And so we'll continue to do that. And one of the questions is, you know, do we have any core real estate at all? Do we have public real estate? And you know, we've been bringing it down. We talk about it. We look at it.
That's one of the things that we're studying internally is how do we think about core real estate and whether we should own it and have a dedicated policy towards it. So that's one
of the things. For some of the biggest names on private real estate that you're describing, fixed broker properties, it's a fund with people in the back.
Yeah, so you'll hear one of the panelists on Friday, John Graham from Blackstone.
Northwood Securities is a big group of ours.
I don't know if you know John Kukrel. He used to be John Gray's partner at Blackstone in the early 2000s.
Actually, John Gray used to be his analyst.
That's right. He was John's Paul. John was John's Paul.
And Wheelock Sweet Capital is another big partner of mine, ours based in Connecticut. Meadow Partners, based in New York. But those guys have really interesting niche strategies where they're focusing on out of favor real estate, which are in sectors that have been out of favor. They look for small deals where they can really come in, get their hands dirty, fix the leasing, drive NOI growth. And we found that we've outperformed
those. We've done what we call sponsoring partnerships, where we essentially put people in business. Either as their anchor tenant or their sole tenant. And a lot of our real estate partners will be here tonight and at the conference, so we'd love to introduce you.
Trying to figure out what could get better from here in real estate. You've got full buildings. You've got people that will buy the projects as fast as somebody can sell them, and cap rates
of 2-3%.
I hear about the spread on cap rates, but just trying to figure out what could possibly get better than where we've been, but maybe it just keeps going. But I like the 6-8% returns. We think we can get that.
Yeah, I think with the 19% returns that we earned last year in real estate are not sustainable in the long term, which is why I said I think it's a low to mid-teens business. If we think we can add value through selecting the right partners, structuring the right type of deals.
Fixing up buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not buying existing buildings that are fully. I mean, it's fixing up.
Yeah, I get that. A lot of people have been doing that for a
while. Yes.
Well, that's some other pretty.
There are other people doing that.
Yeah. Some other pretty niche operational stuff. Tell them about Green Court, for example.
Yeah, I mean, so Green Court Parking Partners. Lot. So one of our managers, they'll be here this week, and they buy parking assets around airports, off of airport parking, and lease them up and look for ways to add ancillary revenue.
And RV parking, RV, because you might be interested in this.
manufactured housing effects, which Bruce refers to as trailer parks with curbs. So, but there's an interesting revenue business, or lease revenue.
Not the RVs themselves, where you park the RVs.
Yeah, those are very
niche, but yeah, they've been around.
Interesting businesses. I'll show you how old we some of us are. That's been going on a long, long
yes,
time.
Yes, sir. Yes,
people
sir.
Have been buying property next to airports and doing RV parks. But yes. I just don't see how it gets better than it's been. But it's,
no, I don't think
you're
so.
With the best people. I mean, you know, John Gray and all these names. So you certainly are in best of breed opportunity.
We look for the right partners, and then you talked about technology. How can we use that to our advantage? So in the real estate space, we look at data centers, we look at
cell towers,
we look at trying to wireless spectrum. So we really try to figure out how can we play that to our advantage.
But Arden, I think, you know, you're right. I mean, there we see very few.
I'm not pronouncing anything to be right on. I'm just observing. The people have been doing cell towers for 20 years, and it's just perfection that's been going on because of this ample
There's one scenario that makes sense, and it's the one we talked about earlier, right? You get the 10-year rate to go to where Germany or Japan's is, and you got another 20% in real estate.
I think so, and as we forget negative rates, if we just keep pushing our yields down on the 10-year and everything else, having income, and by the way, there are interesting yield codes right now out there to be bought publicly, but that's assuming the tenants are still there and the buildings are still full and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, 5 years ago, we had zero in real estate. Well, in zero real estate in Europe, we probably have 15% today. But I mean, this negative yield or this low interest rate environment in Europe has really driven capital values, which we've been able to take advantage of in our European real estate portfolios. As they've recovered and they've kept rates or they keep dropping rates, real estate's been one of those asset classes that has performed exceptionally well for us.
Well, I think what we do very, very well with a great staff is invest through those cycles. You just have to be careful of the vintage risk and this sort of thing.
But you think about tactical allocations. I mean, in terms of U.S., Europe, global, I mean, if you see opportunities in Asia, are we reallocating in out of the 1.5 if we have a liquidation event? I mean, we do?
Yes. I mean, that's exactly what Eddie's Mark before him and McCoon, have been doing. We started in the U.S. because there was still a lot of to resolve there. We teased Eddie about spending all the time in Europe, but we've been buying cheaper properties there. So, we try to follow the crash. We're at about 5% in private real estate equity now, a little more, 5.8%. Our long-term strategy had a number between 7.5 and 10, kind of getting, that's how much, in the overall portfolio, we have 7.5 to 10% in private real estate equity. That felt as a decent general number. And Arden, after 8+ years, I'm just conditioned, every time you talk, I just say you're right. So I do think you're right.
I don't have an answer, but just observing.
I think it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to earn money. It's going
to
be tough.
We got another 20%. Then we need to worry.
But we're already worried. What we feel like I should keep us on pace here a little bit. We want to spend all our time talking about how our venture capital portfolio performed during the past year, which is solely attributable to Susan Chin.
The strong returns are driven by several ideas and strategies from Arch, healthcare venture firm, Foundry, one of our core venture capital partners also some distributions some markups from IA Ventures, another core venture manager. We had some.
All three of whom are going to be here this week.
How many partners do we have in this sector?
There's about 10.
About 10
core. 20 total. Of the $1.4 billion, I think we like $1 billion of it. And $400 million. One of the interesting things we had talked a little bit about what other endowments look like. This represents about 4% of our total assets. A lot of the other endowments, particularly the best performing endowments, will have 8-12% of their assets in venture capital. And some of the largest ones are in that zip code. And so we see other large, well-performing endowments with $2.5 billion, $4 billion venture portfolios. Now, there's a long history there. They got into venture capital in the 90s with the Sequoias and the Kleiner Perkins, and that was pre-UTIMCO, so Russ told you about how we used to, what our, the organization used to work. So it wasn't in those early funds. And then we, when UTIMCO was created and we had the Public Information Act, our venture firms wouldn't take our money because they were concerned about the publicity. So we're not in. We missed. We kind of had two strikes outs at getting into some of those very large, very successful Silicon Valley funds. Now, what Lindell and Laura and Mark Schoberg had done for us 8 years ago was begin to get us into some really good funds like Foundry and Union Square and Arch. And so, you know, they built a nice portfolio. And what Susan and Pat are tasked with, I think happily, is to figure out how to increase the size of this portfolio, because 50% returns on $1.4 billion is really good. 25% returns on $2.5 billion would be even better. So, or threatened, maybe that math didn't work for
us. These expected returns over the next 5 years, I mean, it's...
Right. What's the worst one-year return we've seen in venture? Yeah.
It's been negative.
How negative was it?
We'd have to go back and look. We didn't... I can answer the question. Well, let me go back and get back to you what the industry experienced and what we experienced. Because I don't think we experienced as much negative as the industry experienced because we weren't in it back.
Yeah.
And this has been our highest performing asset class over the last 7 years.
Well, because of this year. A 51% year really helps you a lot. The last couple of years.
So if you took this year out, what would it look like?
It was still pretty good. You know, I don't want to venture a guess. My math is slipping. So I'm going to get back to you.
All right. Bruce, as you think about if the decision's made to ramp up the allocation in this area, do you see that as writing bigger checks to the same number of funds or increasing the number of relationships or co-investing or all of the above?
It's hard to increase the check to the funds that we already like because they don't want to take the concentration risk with investors.
So then that brings up the idea of whether that's area staffed sufficient or no.
Correct. We are, we've hired a search firm.
We are planning to hire one or two folks to help.
And our book has been very predominantly information technology venture capital. And one of the things we've asked Pat to do is help us get a bigger footprint in life sciences venture capital, which is an area I think is really... position to take off. All right, Courtney, we got to go fast.
Slide 45, the $10.5 billion in hedge funds, $671 billion is in three managers that we can categorize as emerging markets. I say that because these three managers have a global mandate, but on average, they've got a half to two-thirds of their exposure in emerging markets. Returns have been strong and consistent, near-term and long-term. Outperforming both fund of funds benchmark as well as the emerging market hedge fund benchmark specifically. You know, we look at long short spread. These managers know differently than we would in the DCE area. We have very high conviction that these three are the ones that can identify those types of spread opportunities and generate consistent returns over time. And so I would expect, you know, call it 6, 7, 8% over a full cycle. And, you know, 1 year returns very positive for the last 12 months, despite, call it a 40% trough drawdown in emerging markets, because they're very good insurance. And so we would expect them to protect capital if we do see emerging markets rollover, but over a full cycle should generate, call it mid teens, long short spread, that should result in, you know, a mid to high teens. Move on to slide 46, investment grade fixed income, similar size, $640 million. This is essentially a global macro portfolio, and it's essentially bridge loan. returns on the long term. You know, 7 years has been 8.8%. It's been strong. It's been declining more recently. We would attribute that to some of the managers we've added over the past 3 or 4 years, Lone Peak, Bain, Woodbine, which are now subsequently out of the portfolio. We'd have two other managers other than Bridgewater. One is Autonomy. It's a holdover from the Lone Peak relationship. EM focused. We really like him. And then we just funded a new macro mandate. The ex-CIO of Soros has launched his own firm. So we funded that this month. The one thing I'd point out is just volatility in the bucket is much higher than the normal or what you'd see at the portfolio level of the hedge fund portfolio. It's really Bridgewater. And had we given all the money to Bridgewater, we would have done much better over the past 3 years. But they target, call it a mid-teens to high-teens volatility as they're managing their book. And so we end up with a higher volatility profile for the cohort. But because of the correlation benefit, we don't really feel it in the broader.
Very market. Uncorrelated to right. The rest of the book.
So we're good with that.
Very quickly, just on private investments, page 40, the calendar year 2015, what I point out is we went into the year bottom left, $7.17 billion, and on the right, we ended the year with $8.5 billion in net asset value in private investments. Went up from 28 to 33%. In the middle, that increase, part of it is we did have more capital called than distributed, 2.1 called, only $1.6 billion distributed, and then we had a large markup of $780 million, 60% of which was in our venture book. And so on the next page, there's a lot of numbers, but basically what we tried to lay out is how we went from having private investments as of May 31st be 28.7% of our total assets to by January 31st being 32.86%. So we went from 29 to 33% of our assets. Part of it is, and then, you know, we try to project this, and so we try to, we look at where the actual difference from our projections. A lot of the difference came in the May to August time period, where basically we had a large markup in the portfolio. The calls and distribution differences kind of netted out. We had that larger markup, mostly in venture, but partly what happened was rather than the overall portfolio growing, the overall endowment growing, it actually stayed fairly steady. And so that accounts for over half of the difference in the percentage increase. And again, in the August to January time period, here we did have more calls and less distribution. Some of our venture capital, Twitter, for example, got marked down. And again, rather than having growth in the overall endowment, it was slightly down. The next section is the risk section, where we go through the various risk metrics. I think in the interest of time, what I'd like to focus on is some scenarios. A lot of work's been done on scenarios, particularly page 45 in your paper copy, page 52, diligent, Uzi, if you want to just highlight, you know, in particular, the China hard landing is where we've spent a fair amount of time over the last few weeks. Kyle's with Kyle's help, we very much appreciate it. What that could look like.
So we're looking at the China hard landing and kind of try to summarize here in a single number, but there's a whole range of things that could happen, both in terms of severity and more severity. Here is the more extreme case where the energy cut might be at 21% drop. In the overall endowment, but that's with a relatively low probability. What's important to understand is, as we all know, markets are very interconnected, both financial markets and the economy. So regardless of how much or how little we are invested in China, if something bad happens in China, it could affect all the markets and therefore our entire portfolio. And it's more difficult because we don't know exactly, obviously, we don't know what will happen, the kind of the second order effect, third order effect, how it will affect us. It's not easy to estimate. On this, and there's also kind of a time lag. There's sometimes a short-term effect, a very short-term effect, like a market time shift. That's not something you're concerned about, but there could be effects over months, and there are effects over years, which are our main concern as long-term investors. On the specific scenario here, kind of it's a very hard landing where we can see basically a world recession, equity markets dropping 30% in developed markets and 40% in emerging markets. And probably it's single digit, that's probably 2-3% probability. More likely, kind of if we cut the numbers in half and a bit less than half, then we can say it's kind of, okay, something that happens in China affects the rest of the world, that developed markets fall 15%. The numbers are not here on the page, but that ended with a drop of 8% with, let's call it 20-25% probability. So, again, these are not trivial numbers. It's very hard to predict, but I think other than the lower returns message that came across many times here, there's also the message of volatility. Kind of when you don't know things around in both directions. Sometimes people think volatility is a good thing because after the drop, kind of there's where we're flying from as opposed to low returns and from where we are because things are elevated. But obviously, at the drop, we would suffer. So, again, we can see the returns dropping, let's call it 8% on with the 25% probabilities on the China hard landing. There's a manager alpha here, which on the China is the largest, because both we have put hedges against specific managers, so it's counted on the manager alpha and stuff. Many of our managers have kind of direct protection. What they're doing is hedging a lot of the currency of, so it will dampen a bit the fall, but it can still be significant. I think this is the key scenario. We're not more defensive than our peers, and again, the 75% or 90%, the 75% probability is this is not going to happen. So we don't want to move our portfolio away after 25%. That's just that we know that the probability of as well as 8% decline if the bad scenario happens.
Also be just a little bit better, right? Because we have our Chinese managers hedged. So your gain for current hedges number wouldn't be zero. It would be a little bit better than that.
Yes. I look back, it's this is within the 3% that's called manager alpha.
Oh, I see. You just allocated it all down there.
It's probably mislabeled, but it was allocated.
I see. Okay. Thanks for doing that. I appreciate it.
Bruce, have you priced out where you find these specific risks? Have you priced out what the hedges, the cost of hedges relative to those risks?
We have been looking at several hedges. Some are kind of just change the portfolio, which is a symmetric hedge, like short or hedge the Chinese currency exposure. Mm-hmm. Is something we are doing. We are looking also at options. Options tend to be pricey. The people that are offering them are the banks, the ones that have the least capability to provide something when markets fall, so they tend to be pricey. But we are looking at options for a long while. I didn't see any option that's worthwhile, so kind of our line of defense is seeing something might happen is change the corpus.
Are you really the most efficient thing to do is go into cash?
Right.
And we are running a little high in cash, but we don't move it around. That was it for the funds update. Thanks, everybody, for their patience. I thought it might be helpful to spend a lot of time letting you know what you own.
Okay, great. Next item is presentation of the investment strategy. Bruce, would you please take us through the presentation and let's move through
yes,
this pretty quick.
Yes, all I really wanted to do here is kind of initiate a conversation to take place over the next 5 or 6 months about our basic investment strategy. We've talked a lot about how good it's been for the last 5 or 6 years and the challenges that we think we'll see over the next period. As you know, we do try to analyze peers and see what they've done and what's worked and what's haven't worked. And so it was in that context that we wanted to lay out and then also talk about why we are where we are, what was some of the backdrop for that. Going into the financial recession, we held up pretty well. We wanted to protect capital because of a lot of concerns we had. And so we engineered the portfolio we engineered. And we did protect capital. We generated sufficient returns. Others that took a different tack benefited from the monetization more so than we did. But the real question, I think, is, so given where we are now, where do we want to be? Going forward, what's the optimal strategy? And, and so I just laid out on page 4, 83 in Diligent, some of the, some of the key issues that we're beginning to debate or continue to debate internally as staff, but that we also want to engage you, the board, in and engage our client, UT System and AM System, in that discussion. Obviously, it doesn't really lend itself to a short period of time in a public forum, and so what we'll look to do is reach out and have, much more detailed discussions individually with you, maybe in some small groups, continue to put the issues, make sure we're putting the issues on the table, and as staff bringing to bear whatever data and analysis we can, so it's clear to our clients what are the choices that we're making.
Does that mean you'll be coming to us with recommendations?
We will. Ultimately, we will. So the answer is yes, but what I prefer to do is, say, in March, come to you with issues, and in April and May, talk about different pros and cons.
But ultimately, you'll come to us.
Yes, ultimately, we view our job as staff is to make a recommendation to you. Yes, sir.
And so, Bruce, the staff, just in as we know, we're going into an environment where there's headwinds in terms of returns for a whole variety of reasons. And so how often does the staff collectively get together and talk about maybe a realignment of the portfolio? Because clearly it's got to start at the staff level and then, work its way up to the board. And I think that we can be helpful in that regard. But how often are you doing retreats? Are you looking at this on a five-year plan, on a vision basis? How do you do that?
So yes. In 08, we kind of did a five-year plan. In 10 or in 12, we kind of updated that. So we've done a couple of five-year projections, two or three. We have had some off-sites. We've had a couple of them with a couple of board members, a handful of staff. We've done a couple of those. That might be, we found those very helpful. Annually, we go through a more formal process as required in the Investment Management Services Agreement where we make our projections, asset class projections, and run the models. Although, the last number of years, that's been anchored or grounded in kind of the current portfolio and the five-year view. So, it's probably a good year to devote more time and effort to that. And then, monthly, we have a portfolio positioning task force. Susan heads it, where we talk, that's where we'll say, okay, should we lighten up on the gold or lighten up on the commodities or hey, we're overweight in privates, let's go underweight in publics in that asset class. And then, you know, we yell at each other every day in the hall. So, but those are the different ways we've been going about it. And I think what will be helpful this year is, you know, more thorough, spending more time and effort on it, kind of a more thorough blank page, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we really want to engage you that are on the board, our client, because we think, you know, these are very consequential decisions. And we can't turn everything around, you know, we can't change everything immediately, but we begin to put in motion certain things. And depending upon what our investment priorities are, that impacts where we should have staff.
But it sounds to me like you're making these adjustments kind of day in and day out to some degree. So what are you asking us to look at in terms of sweeping changes or, you know, fundamental changes in the policy? Because you're obviously addressing these pretty routinely.
We are addressing them, we think. And if we were convinced we ought to have fundamental changes, we would have made those recommendations. So we're not here to say we need to fundamentally change what we're doing. But what we do want to do is go through a process over the next 6 months, internally as staff, but also with you, making, you know, just kind of making sure the big choice, the big issues, the big choices are on the table and are clear, and what the risks are, where we might miss, where we might hit, just so that we're not taking anything for granted.
Bruce, let me.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. First, let me say that how impressed I am with the expertise and professionalism of your staff. I think they're doing a terrific job. And I'm probably the only one in this room that doesn't know the answer to this question, but do we have a process where we evaluate our external managers? And if so, how often do we do that? Because it looks to me like we're going to have some, as Jeff says, some real headwinds in the foreseeable future. And I just think we need to make sure that all hands are on deck, if you will.
So I suppose the formal process is I have semi-annual reviews with each of our investment teams where we, you know, spend half a day and go through the portfolio, or 2 or 3 hours and we go through the portfolio. And by the way, UT System Finance sits in on many of them. They're certainly invited. So that's kind of a formal process we go through. I'd say it is our day job. So, I mean, every day, those are the issues we're looking at. Do we have confidence in this manager? Do we not? Do we want to bring on this new manager? Do we want to redeem from this existing manager? Do we redeem fully or partially? A lot of that takes place in the hedge fund portfolio. And, for example, part of their process is they have a capital plan. So they've got an idea, kind of an 18-month plan on these are the managers we're going to take money from, these are the managers we're going to add money to, these are new managers we're going to bring on. The same thing in the public equity book. And these are monthly, tend to be kind of monthly decisions, but you know, so we've got a longer-term capital plan, and then we have our formal semi-annual views, but I can tell you every day we're talking about it. I'll go into someone's office, they'll come in my office. We also have an investment committee that meets every other week where we look at new investments and we rotate looking at different people's portfolios. So those are kind of both the formal and
informal. So the short answer is we do have a process.
Yes, we have lots of, we have both formal and informal processes.
I think that's been borne out many times. A great question in terms of making sure whether it's still being done right or whether it's using best practices, et cetera.
Right.
I always think when I hear about an investment in Singapore or Africa or India, you know, who's helping externally? Do we have best practices on consultants helping us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I can tell you from the outside, people view it very, very hard to get to invest with them. I think they're viewed as being very smart, rigorous, and trade very tough in terms of what they want to do. Having said that, bigger issue, and we've had a lot of discussions. I'm rolling off the board. There have been a lot of discussions about it. Jeff and I have talked a lot about it, and Bruce and I have talked a lot about it. Part of what I think is worthy of review in your hearing is making sure the client and us are on the same page every day. I would tell you the big secret. This is not a trading operation. This is not a lot of swashbuckling going on up here. It's not a lot of room for craziness. Let's knock on wood. If you took all the endowments, top 20, top 100, Nakubo, which measure, there's really not much difference in a lot of, because we're on an endowment model. That's what we use. Time tested in his fiduciaries, that's what we use. The alternative would be something different than endowment model. Maybe it's buying and selling stocks every day, we're trading, what have you. But on the endowment model we have, we are at variance with everybody else by definition. Some endowments mentioned earlier today, for instance, may own millions of acres of timber. Somebody may own rock quarries in Africa. Somebody may own direct oil and gas themselves, et cetera. By the way, interesting that those folks get to mark those books the way they want sometimes when they're private investments. We don't have that advantage. We are typically, along this endowment model, investing in these available managers. What's important, and the reason this is relevant, is if you look at the numbers today, by the way, I think it bears out from looking at it, on all those time periods over time, we're in positive performance. Secondly, all those time periods would beat the benchmarks. Correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, with all the groupings of the top 20 endowments, top 50 endowments, where do we set? We don't set at the very top of those 20 or 100. We're probably, we reside where we reside based on the results of this endowment. I think what's key, and part of my sort of parting comment today, would be, we talked offline quite a bit about this for some months. It's been very important in my mind that we do. Because there is turnover on this board, and there's turnover on that board. Very important, and the A&M board as well. Very important we communicate about what the goals are, especially with regard to risk tolerance. We have this board, just so you have some perspective, since we've all been on here at different lengths of time, we've had board declarations here that we want to be just middle of the pack. That's the goal. That's been stated. We've had in some down markets, chairs of the client tell us you don't want to be down 20%. That's not tolerable. By the way, that's understandable. We have issues, liquidity issues. We have bond rating issues. We have all sorts of things. So we're on an endowment mix that is probably set to not be the riskiest. That's why we talk a lot about risk-adjusted returns. We also don't do huge, 5 million acre purchases of timber directly and things like that. So I just think that that retreat sort of workshop sort of making sure, Chancellor, the just real discussion among the client, Jeff and I have talked many times about it, I know he totally agrees, with this board is really key. Because if there is a recession, you notice in our shock scenarios, I always kid, we never put an old-fashioned bear market on there. You can do the math on that. What if we go down 20% a year for 2 years? But you don't want somebody going, what's going on over there? How are you down? Or I was in a phone call when somebody said, don't be down 20% ever. We won't tolerate that. So I just think there ought to be, and by the way, you're seeing some numbers under the scenario analysis that have a step down with a 2 in front of them. So I would just make sure in this process, and that's what's really driving a lot of this, is that there's a real communication between the client and us as fiduciaries. And some of you, I realize, wear multiple hats. But really trying to just fulfill that goal. And by the way, being about that far apart on certain allocations to certain asset classes versus our peers can make it seem like, well, I'm sitting down here versus here. So, and if the markets go down, the performance may be a different story versus peers. Is that a fair representation?
It's a very fair representation. I've been pitching for a long time now this notion of transparency between this board and the UT and the A&M board. And I'm not sure we've always had that. I think it's been a bit opaque to the UT board and the A&M board as to what's going on here. And collectively, if we make the decision that we want to be at the middle of the pack or we don't want to have a drawdown of more than 15%, that's fundamentally something that needs to be achieved at the UT board level, not at this board level, in my mind. And so
I've been under the impression that may need a refresher.
Yes.
Even if we change nothing, we may just want to make sure everybody's all on the same page.
Transparency.
Yeah.
Between what's happening here and what's happening at the board, because look, it's our, you know, we're going to ask for the 4.5-5% distribution until the end of time. And so I've told Bruce all we need is a 5+2 model. He has to guarantee a 5% distribution with 2% inflation factor, beat the policy, and benchmark.
The deflation's looking good now. That's 5%.
Sign me up.
There you go.
I'm in.
Sign you up.
Sign me up.
You notice I didn't mention distribution issues, and that's a stress on this board for the non-regional members. It's if we're not living
stress on some of us as well.
Yeah. And so that's not typically what one would want to do, but that happens. The other thing we have is this thing out there that's typically a good thing, but it's a commodity-driven asset and income stream, and how that gets thought about in relation to all of this. But I can tell you that distribution policy that's not followed puts one more stress on how you manage and whether you might want to be slightly more conservative versus slightly more risky. But you put that together with a liquidity preference and policies with a need for AAA ratings, and then some people grab it and needing funds more than the distribution amount. It probably makes folks, a very hardworking staff, want to make sure they protect what we have and manage it in a very prudent way. So good, it's a good time for, because of all the new faces in both rooms, a reboot of just touching base on that.
Good. Thank you.
Or you could also vote to extend term limits.
We could,
if
yes.
If you wanted to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Well,
is that a motion?
Is that a motion?
I'll still be here every meeting. I'm just going to be sitting there. I'm going to see you tomorrow.
I'm going to hold you to that.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I'll bring you along and make sure you come along.
All right. Any other comments? Bruce?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for the comments. Next item on the agenda is the report from the Audit and Ethics Committee. Director John White was not able to attend the meeting, so Director Phil Adams will present the report. Phil, please take us through
your
report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief here. The Audit and Ethics Committee met twice since our last report to this board, January 15th, then again February 17th. All directors were present at both meetings. Chairman Hildebrand also attended the January 15th meeting. At the January 15th meeting, the committee considered two action items. The minutes, of course, from the November 11th meeting were approved as drafted. And the UTEMCO compensation program participation for our corporate counsel and chief compliance officer for the 2015-2016 performance period. No other items were discussed at the January 15th meeting. At the February 17th meeting, the committee again considered two action items. Minutes, of course, from the previous January 15th meeting were approved as drafted. And Deloitte and Touche financial statement, audit results, and communications letter and audited financial statements for the corporation were approved and subject to this board's approval. On the February 17th meeting, the committee also heard reports from Robert Cowley of Deloitte and Touche of Deloitte on the audit results and communications letter, the audit reports for the corporation, and the statement of investment performance statistics issued by Deloitte. Also, Deloitte, they audited the August 31st, 2015 and 2014 financial statements of the corporation and issued an unqualified opinion. Again, Robert Cowley, who's the Deloitte engagement partner, presented the audit results and communications letter to the committee and answered the director's questions related to financial statements. As well, SISI reported on compliance matters, including the quarterly compliance summary, the annual report on the institutional compliance program, and an update on fiscal year 2016 on the 2016 action plan. And finally, Joan Mueller reported on the unaudited financial statements as of November the 30th, 2015, for the Permanent University Fund, the General Endowment Fund, the Permanent Health Fund, the Long-Term Fund, the Intermediate-Term Fund, and UTEMCO. The committee also went into executive session to receive advice from counsel. The committee is requesting action on two resolutions related to the audit of the corporation for the fiscal year ended August 31st, 2015. First, approval of Deloitte & Touche's financial statement, audit results, and communications for the corporation for the year ended August 31st, 2015. And second, for approval of the annual financial statements and audit report for the corporation for fiscal years ended August 31st, 2015 and August 31st, 2014. And of course, we have a copy of the audit results and communication, and the audited financial statements are included in our board materials. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the report from the Audit and Ethics Committee.
Great. Thank you very much, Director Adams. So may I have a motion to approve the resolution related?
Can I say one thing real quick? Yes. I just want to thank and acknowledge Melinda Shepherd and Joan Mueller. We always pass our audits without any comments, but we never take it for granted. So we're very appreciative of the work you all do.
Thank you very much. So may I have a motion to approve the resolution related to the Deloitte & Touche LLP financial statement, audit results, and communications, and the audited financial statements of UTEMCO?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Next item on the agenda is the report from the Risk Committee. There are no action items in the section. Kyle, take us through your report.
Sure. The Risk Committee convened via a teleconference on February 16th. All directors were present. The committee considered two action items at the meeting. The minutes from the November 18th meeting were approved as drafted, and we had 16 new mandates categorized by staff that were approved. Routine business included a report from CISI on quarterly compliance matters after a brief presentation from Bruce on performance and risk reporting. We also discussed adding some risk sections to the Board of Directors report that Uzi and his team added today. We are appreciative of those reports. There are no items from the Risk Committee that need action by the Board. This concludes my report from the Risk Committee.
Thank you very much. Bruce, next item on is the UTEMCO organization update. Any issues?
We are staying within our budget. We have a number of open positions. If you think it's hard to get money from UTEMCO, it's hard to get a job at UTEMCO. So we are being very thorough, using search firms, talking to a lot of people, because when we bring people onto the staff, we want to make sure they're great. And we, I think, have a great track record of that, and we're going to keep it up.
You do. Are you finding, just given the economic uncertainty, headwinds, are you finding more people looking for jobs, higher quality people? Do you have greater pick of people?
Yeah, it's a little mixed. Some of the jobs are pretty hard, the EM Asia job. But we, for example, we've got a couple of candidates, one who's coming down for the conference. So I think we're seeing some people on the credit. Hedge fund, private investments, Ryan was saying, it's not getting necessarily great flow. I don't know, those of you that are, we just started the technology search. We're kind of in the very early innings of a lower middle market and a search and a real estate search. So we've had some open positions, some turnover. And in Joan, with Joan and Sissy and John, and I think they've been finding some talented people. So all in all, okay. But
what I'd say is I think the perception of working at UTEMCO has really grown over the years. It's considered a really good brand in the institutional space, but even more than that, I think over the past, since Bruce has been here, and I think with the board's backing, we're not doing plain vanilla investing. we're doing some pretty interesting, pretty leading edge kind of investing, and I think people think it's an attractive platform for that reason. So I'd say it's not a volume. We're not getting more resumes. I'd say we're getting better resumes, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
And Austin, attractive place to live. And I think
you can find a place to live. Yeah.
it's
a great town if you can find a place to live.
Great. Thank you very much. Last night.
Drive to College Station. Yeah.
You want a hotel room, it's not a problem.
Just on them hills that Austin's got.
That's an awesome real estate.
The last item on the agenda relates to three corporate resolutions. First is the designation of the annual meeting of the UTEMCO Board as May 5th, 2016. May I have a motion to designate the May 5th meeting as the annual meeting of the UTEMCO Board?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The second and third resolutions are resolutions of deep appreciation for two directors that are leaving the board in the very near future. First is John White. John was unfortunately not able to attend the meeting, and I will say from a personal perspective, it has been a real joy to work with John. I knew him in an earlier part of my life. He has always been so thoughtful and brings a really bright intellect to the team. And so, personally, I very much appreciate John's service. And then secondly...
And John will be here tomorrow and Friday.
Oh, good. Okay.
And tomorrow night with his wife.
And then secondly, Arden Moore, this fine gentleman to my left, vice chair. He was appointed to the Board of Regents of the University of Texas System to the UTEMCO Board on July 13th, 2006, and is the longest-serving UTEMCO Board member.
He's a lifetime member.
It is a lifetime. It's like dog years here. But I would say...
It seems like 20 years.
These statements actually seem very trite to me, just given the amount of time that I've spent with Arden, his wisdom, his engagement, his loyalty and passion. He has just been a very fine friend and co-board member, and I've really leaned on him in a significant way. I sincerely appreciate your wisdom over the last few years that we've worked together.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I'd like to add that you have been the one on this board with the level head through the financial crisis. You're someone that I look up to and always even seek counsel for professionally and personally. You've been the best devil's advocate. Even if your opinion is heavily leaning one way, you are the master at coming up with counterfactuals and thinking about everything that could go wrong on the other side. So you brought tremendous wealth of private investing knowledge to this board, and we're all going to miss you personally and professionally, and we're sad to see you go.
Thank you.
Amen. It's been a privilege to spend 5 years, I guess, with Arden on this board, and it's one of a kind. He's the best, and I think we could make him a permanent committee member of the compensation group.
Chairman.
That is a splendid idea.
He really enjoys that.
Emeritus.
Love it.
Thank you, guys.
Right. Anyone else? Right.
Very much appreciated. The place has been great, and I've been very lucky in my life. Keep it short, because I'm going to see you all tomorrow, by the way. And I'll still come to meetings and just sit in the back. I've been lucky to be around folks that are much more talented than me all my life, and this is no exception. And I can tell you that I have learned more and benefited more from the directors here, the past directors, and the staff, UTEMCO, than I have. Put in. I've gotten more out than I've put in, let me tell you that. So it's been great. It's such a classy, great place. And, of course, I love the University of Texas and A&M. And I'm just continually, as I've said, I think a couple times a year for 9 years, just so impressed with not only the quality of the board members, but the staff here, their dedication, their intellect, their loyalty, and the way they behave and conduct themselves, and the way they interact with the board. So it's a really special place, And Chancellor, I know that you come to see that and know how much I think this board cares about doing a good job for the client. And you're hearing some good conversation today on wanting to be earnest and making sure that we're real time and taking a zero-based look at how we can be as good as we can be. So it's been my pleasure. I look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow. But thank you for the privilege of being on here. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Gifts here for you. Thank
so
you.
May I have a motion on the resolutions of appreciation?
Yes. Can we Skype my mother in?
Yes, we may. For Director John White and Director Arden Moore. Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the resolution. Vote.
Okay. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Thank you guys very much.
Have to get the cufflinks back.
Okay.
Got those on the first day. Thank you, guys.
You want to open it? Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
All right.
Open this.
You want to open it?
Which one?
All three of them, or at least one of them.
There's one so big it has to sit on the floor.
I can't lift the one on the floor.
How about I thought these were John's?
Can we adjourn? Let's adjourn the meeting, and then you can open them. How about, any further business?
No.
Meeting's adjourned. All right. Thank you, guys.